Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Friday, the 12th of July, these are our main stories. President Trump announces that a contentious question on citizenship will not be included in the 2020 census. The U.S. condemns Iran for harassing a British oil tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. And an already flooded New Orleans prepares for the possible arrival of a hurricane on Friday night. Also in this podcast,
we stumble across the very heart of the problem, an illegal makeshift laboratory where a group of young men are mixing coca leaves with water and acid in a barrel.
We head to Colombia, where they're producing more cocaine than ever. But let's start with what President Trump's critics would call a climb down on his promise to get a citizenship question in the 2020 U.S. Census, despite it being blocked by the U.S. Supreme Court. In a much-anticipated address from the Rose Garden at the White House, Mr. Trump said that he was issuing an executive order that would allow his administration to count the number of citizens without having to include the question in the census.
Today I'm here to say we are not backing down on our effort to determine the citizenship status of the United States population. We will defend the right of the American people to know the full facts about the population, size of citizens and non-citizens in America.
I heard more from our U.S. correspondent, Peter Bowes.
He said he wasn't backing down, but most people are interpreting this as him doing just that. That he's backing off from his attempt to get that key question on the census next year about the citizenship of people. So instead, what he says he's going to do through this executive order is get the various different government departments to collate existing data. So that's the Social Security Administration, Homeland Security, the Internal Revenue Service already have huge amounts of information about people living in this country, including information about citizenship, and to use the president's words, they would leave no stone unturned in terms of their efforts to get an accurate count and accurate information about the citizenship of everyone living in the United States.
And in a certain way, he says, or politically, one could say that it's still keeping the issue of illegal immigration in the minds of voters. Some would say it's not all bad for him.
Yes, I mean, he's keeping the issue going. It might, I think, be seen as a negative for the president, because I think a lot of people thought that he just wanted to make a political statement by adding that very pertinent question to the census, which clearly won't happen now. But in the meantime, this count based on existing data will go on. I think it remains to be seen how groups around the country will respond to that, although it should really be said that there's probably little anyone can do about it because that data already exists.
Peter Bowes. Tensions between Iran and the UK are rising again as the UK blamed Iran for trying to block the passage of a British oil tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran denied any involvement, but Britain said it had to send a Royal Navy ship to intercept three Iranian military boats. A spokesperson for the US State Department, Morgan Ortagus, said Britain was right to act as it did.
We commend the actions of the Royal Navy in ensuring freedom of navigation and the free flow of commerce through this critically important waterway. We will continue to work closely with the United Kingdom and our allies to ensure the Iranian regime's malign activities do not further disrupt international law, maritime security, or global commerce.
Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams has this report.
The government is clearly concerned that life for British-flagged ships in the Gulf is becoming increasingly dangerous. It raised its ship security level to the highest category, 3, essentially warning British ships to stay out of Iranian waters. The decision was taken on Tuesday, before yesterday's episode in which a tanker, British Heritage, was intercepted by 3 Iranian fast boats, apparently in an effort to force the tanker to stop or change course. A nearby British warship, HMS Montrose, positioned itself between the tanker and the Iranian vessels, issued verbal warnings and forced them to turn away. Some reports suggest HMS Montrose briefly trained its guns on the Iranians before they backed off. The government says it's determined to defend UK maritime interests, but says it has no interest in escalating this delicate situation with Iran. The Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, said he was watching events in the Gulf closely.
Obviously very concerning developments, but also I'm very proud of the Royal Navy and the role that they played in keeping British assets, British shipping safe. We are continuing to monitor the situation very, very carefully.
Iran denies confronting any foreign vessels in the Gulf, but yesterday's incident follows repeated Iranian warnings of retaliation following last week's detention off Gibraltar of a tanker carrying Iranian oil, which Britain says was destined for Syria, something Iran also disputes. The police in Gibraltar have seized documents and electronic devices from the tanker, Grace One, and arrested its chief officer for breaking EU sanctions on Syria.
Paul Adams. Washington may now push harder for some kind of multilateral naval protection force in the region. In a statement, the U.S. Central Command said threats to international freedom of navigation require an international solution. Here's our Washington correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher.
The statement from CENTCOM also said that the world economy depends on the free flow of commerce and all nations are obliged to protect that. And it sounds like a plug for this multinational operation that the U.S. has been trying to create to protect commercial vessels in the Gulf. And they've been trying to recruit other countries to send vessels to patrol and to escort and so on, especially Asian countries, countries like India, South Korea, Japan, because they get a lot of their oil from the Middle East. And there have been some contributions so far, but there is a reluctance on the part of Asia to seem to be hostile to Iran as being part of a U.S.-led force. And that is one of the problems of the Americans trying to put this together. The Europeans, of course, would be better placed to contribute because they have more boats and bases in the region. They also have reservations because they essentially blame the U.S. for the standoff. But now with a British ship targeted, perhaps that will help to change minds. That's what President Trump thinks anyway, or what he hopes, because he's just tweeted, it seems the Brits, the French, and the Germans are starting to see that Iran is up to no good.
Barbara Plett-Usher. As rain continues to pelt down, leaving parts of the U.S. city of New Orleans underwater, a tropical storm is moving towards the Louisiana coast. The city's mayor, LaToya Cantrell, warned residents to seek shelter before it hit or to leave New Orleans as Storm Barry looks set to become a hurricane. Manuel Bojorquez from CBS sent this report from New Orleans.
Mandatory evacuations are happening in low-lying parishes south of New Orleans. But here in the city, all eyes are on the Mississippi River, and here's why. Flooding along the nation's midsection has sent a lot of water downstream, so the river is already swollen. That, coupled with the potential storm surge from the tropical system and the additional rain, could spell trouble. Officials have said they believe the levees that protect the city will hold during the event, but they fear that the water could overtop some of them. So while there is still uncertainty in the track of that tropical system, they're urging everyone here to be prepared.
Manuel Bojorquez from CBS. Saudi Arabia has very strict controls governing women's lives, but that could be about to change, as I heard from our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
What is being mooted as a change is the travel restrictions on Saudi women, which is one of the main problems that they face in Saudi Arabia. In order to travel abroad, and even to travel internally in Saudi Arabia to an extent, Saudi women need permission from a male relative. Now, that could even be their son. It could be somebody younger than them if their husband has died or their father has died. Now, there's nothing concrete that has yet happened, but a couple of days ago in a leading Saudi newspaper, the front page said that there was a committee set up to look at the male guardianship laws, and one of the recommendations they'd come up with was that women over the age of 18 should be able to travel without the need of a male guardian giving them permission, also saying that men under the age of 21 should also be allowed that right. So that is a move forward. It hasn't happened yet. It said also that it came from the highest source. Now, that implies it's Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, a man who's most senior and important at the moment in Saudi Arabia. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal today quoting a number of senior Saudi sources who were saying similar things. So it all seems to be percolating. It all seems to be leading us in the way we've had before in Saudi Arabia towards some kind of change.
How will this be seen by Saudi women activists?
I think it will be seen, well, it has been seen already as a positive move. There have been other moves. There has been some relaxation of some other elements of male guardianship. But I mean, as long as there are the leaders leading women activists who are still in Saudi Arabia, still in detention, and these are the people who have advocated male guardianship, I think they will look very sceptically at any of these moves and see it more as a PR campaign than anything else.
Sebastian Usher. Statistics show that Colombia is producing more cocaine than ever, a worrying development in a country where illegal drugs have fueled armed conflict for decades. President Iván Duque says he wants to restart the controversial policy of spraying the coca crop to destroy it, despite widespread concerns about the impact on health and the environment. And that in turn highlights the failure of an ambitious scheme to persuade farmers to destroy their coca fields and start growing other crops introduced as part of the 2016 peace agreement. Matthew Charles reports from the state of Antioquia in northern Colombia.
In the town of Santa Rita, hundreds of coca farmers took to the streets to protest. They said they'd held up their side of the deal with the government by destroying their coca crops. But more than a year later, the funds they were promised had not arrived. Fabian Garcia farms on the hills close by. He'd voluntarily eradicated his 1 hectare of coca, but said he was now struggling to put food on the table.
Ahora nos quedamos, como he dicho, sin el pan y sin el queso, porque...
We've been left on the breadline. We've stopped doing what was bringing in the food. Trust in the state has left us practically suffering from hunger.
And he had a warning for the government.
Hopefully this program will arrive here as quickly as possible, because if not, people will return to growing coca. So we demand the state complies with its commitments, because there are no alternatives.
Shortly after I met Fabian, the promised funding came through. But tens of thousands of others across Colombia are still waiting, and the program has been suspended for new applicants. But Emilio Achila, the presidential commissioner responsible for coca substitution, says voluntary substitution is an important part of government policy. 700 kilometres away from Santa Rita is Cauca, one of Colombia's biggest coca-growing regions, where the slopes are lined with the luscious green of the coca plant. The roads here only go so far. The coca-growing communities are hidden in the hills, on the margins of society.
We've climbed steep slopes, crossed streams, and walked through ditches. There's absolutely no infrastructure in this part of the world.
But it's where, after 2 hours, we stumble across the very heart of the problem, an illegal makeshift laboratory where a group of young men are mixing coca leaves with water and acid in a barrel and using cement and petrol to create coca paste. They tell us this paste is taken elsewhere to be crystallised and converted into cocaine. There's no narco-bling here. These farmers are at the bottom of the international supply chain.
Porque el gobierno no dio más alternativas de...
Jorge, who doesn't want to give his surname, denies he's a criminal and says he's simply doing what he can to get by.
No, aquí es por necesidad, porque si no, uno prácticamente...
We do this out of necessity. If not, we would die of hunger because legal crops do not bring in enough for survival.
Regulación! Regulación!
I've travelled on to Cauca's regional capital, Popayán, to meet another group of frustrated coca farmers. At a conference, they call on the government to honour its commitments made under the peace agreement. They're especially worried about the aerial fumigation program.
Where have you come from today?
From the municipality of Argelia, in the south of Colombia. Argelia, for example, is a place that's been fumigated many times, and every time this happens, it just leaves destruction. Destruction of the environment, destruction of food crops, destruction of animals, and destruction of families.
There may be music after the talking, but the mood of the farmers is one of growing anger. The government has made explicit commitments to 99,000 families as part of the substitution programme, and tens of thousands of others now blocked from the scheme remain in limbo. Colombia's fragile peace may well depend on finding a sustainable solution to the coca issue, and quickly.
Matthew Charles reporting from Colombia. Still to come in this podcast...
We left home at 5 o'clock this morning, and we love the queuing experience. We like to see people try to push in and get pushed back. We enjoy that very much.
We hear from some avid tennis fans waiting in the legendary Wimbledon queue. Now to the mystery of an Italian schoolgirl who went missing 36 years ago. Emanuela Orlandi was last seen in 1983 on her way home from a music lesson in Rome. She's a citizen of the Vatican, and earlier this year, her family received an anonymous letter suggesting her remains might be buried in a cemetery within the tiny papal state. On Thursday, two graves were opened as part of the investigation. James Menendez heard more from our Rome correspondent, James Reynolds, who was at the graveside.
At 8:15 in the morning, a prayer was said in front of two tombs in the Teutonic Cemetery inside the Vatican. And then these tombs, one of an 18th century German princess, the other of a 19th century German princess, were hammered open. Four workmen each took the heavy stones off, and then a search was carried out. But to everybody's surprise, no remains were found at all, not even of the two princesses themselves. No one really has an explanation for that. But the upshot, of course, is simple. The body, the remains of Emanuela Orlandi, the missing schoolgirl herself, were not found there. The mystery goes on. This was a dead end.
And a huge disappointment for the family, I presume.
Yes, I think it's a source of some frustration, although Pietro Orlandi, when he spoke to the BBC several days ago, said he was actually hoping that her remains wouldn't be found there, that he still has the faint hope that she might be alive and that confirming her death was perhaps something that he was not ready for. But I think it is a very frustrating period for the family. They have spent decades searching for news, for credible leads of what happened to Emanuela, and now they're no further on.
So many questions, but is the thinking that there is a Vatican link to all this?
It's something that the family has kept on coming back to year after year. There have been so many wild rumours and speculations, it's not worth going through all of them. But one thing that keeps coming back is this. She was the daughter of a Vatican City employee, and therefore the suspicion is that that might have provided a motivation for someone. And that's, of course, why the search was carried out inside Vatican grounds. Pietro Orlandi himself had said in recent days that he believed the current Pope, Francis, had not actually done enough, had simply said that his sister, Emanuela, was dead and that the Pope wasn't doing enough. So I think you've seen certainly throughout the day, the Vatican has been very, very keen to show that it is doing everything it can to meet the family's needs. That's, of course, after the family has heavily criticised both the Vatican and the Pope.
James Reynolds speaking to James Menendez. The United Nations Refugee Agency and the International Organization for Migration have called on the European Union to restart naval patrols in the Mediterranean to rescue migrants. In a hard-hitting joint statement, they've also said that support for the Libyan Coast Guard should be made conditional on any rescued migrants they return to Libya not being detained. Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, reports.
The UNHCR and the IOM are pushing hard for a rethink on migration in the Mediterranean. They want the EU to resume state-run naval patrols. Earlier this year, the EU restricted its coordinated rescue mission, Operation Sophia, to air patrols. The agencies also hit out at the criminalisation of charity-run rescue vessels, clearly with Italy in mind, but without naming it in their statement. They said the charities had played a crucial role in saving lives. Only the Libyan Coast Guard, they say, can legally return rescued migrants to Libya, and only then if they're not detained. All other vessels can't consider Libya a safe country of return. Earlier this month, more than 50 migrants were killed in an airstrike on a detention centre near Tripoli.
Danny Eberhard. Now, do you see yourself as a bit of a proficient poker player? Good enough, perhaps, to beat an artificial intelligence robot? Well, according to a paper published in the journal Science, you're probably not. That's because for the first time, an AI program has defeated leading poker professionals in a six-way, no-limit session of Texas Hold'em, the world's most popular version of the game. Tim Franks heard more from one of those top poker players who lost to the AI program, Michael Gagliano.
So it was all done over the computer. Before each session, I was given kind of links to each table that we're going to be playing. Most sessions, we played four tables at a time, and I would just simply like log in through the computer and do it that way. They had the AI set up on their end. So for me, it was just like playing online poker, like I usually do, you know, most days of the year.
Right. When you say you were playing, there was four tables. So were there other players at the same time alongside you playing this program?
Yeah, there were two setups for the experiment. So it was six players at the table at a time. There was one setup where there was one human and five AIs all playing independently. And there was a second setup where there were five humans and one AI playing. I was part of the one where it was five humans and one AI. And for each session that I played, it was the same five humans at all the tables that I was playing at once.
And over a period of hours, the AI program came out on top.
It did. So in any sort of multi-handed, multi-competitor format of poker, it is possible for more than one person at the table to win or to lose. The big takeaway from this was that the AI did not lose. It did win.
Why is this an achievement? I mean, I realize that professional poker players are an intelligent bunch, but so are chess players. And, you know, we're used to the idea of computer programs being able to beat the best chess players in the world. What do you think it is about poker that means that this is a significant advance in AI?
The biggest advancement is that it's a multi-person format. It's not just one-on-one. There have been programs developed, there have been AI used in the past, but they've only been able to play one-on-one against one single opponent. This is an AI looking at a table full of people and still coming out on top. The amount of possible scenarios, possible decisions, different variables that happen when you add people is just exponential and astronomical. In the past, no one thought it would be possible for a computer to actually be able to win, be able to play a good strategy, but they've done it.
Professional poker player Michael Gagliano speaking to Tim Franks. In Australia, tourists are rushing to climb the country's most famous natural monument, Uluru, before a permanent ban comes into place. The authorities have repeatedly called for visitors to show respect towards the emblematic rock for its cultural value and importance. Richard Hamilton told me more.
The original Aboriginal local people known as the Anangu have always regarded Uluru as a sacred rock, and they have been campaigning for many years to prevent visitors and tourists from climbing on the rock, because they say it literally wears away the rock. And Uluru is the home of the ancestral spirits and stories from these ancient people. And finally, in 2017, the Uluru National Park voted to ban climbing, and that ban would come into effect in October this year. But as a result, people are rushing to climb it. And the authorities are saying you can still come and visit, but try and keep the climbing to a minimum. So Stephen Schwer is from Tourism Central Australia.
We just need people to travel with respect, plan and book their trip in advance, and don't think that you can park anywhere and camp, because that's not the case. You actually need to make use of the designated facilities.
And Richard, just how bad has it got?
Well, for example, as soon as this ban was announced in 2018, they had 70,000 more visitors, going up to about 500,000 than they had from the previous year. And just today, a photograph was put up on social media showing a sort of snaking-like queue of people. It's a bit reminiscent of the climbers climbing up Mount Everest. There must be dozens of people with hardly any room in between them. The campsite is bursting at the seams. There's only one toilet and that's blocked. And people are pulling over and camping on the side of the road and dumping their rubbish.
And people have been doing very unusual things on the rock as well for a very long time, haven't they?
That's right. And this doesn't help the feeling amongst the Aboriginal people that it's very disrespectful. So in 2010, for example, a French-born exotic dancer stripped off on top of Uluru. It was Alize Seri who said her stripping off was a tribute to indigenous culture, and she defended her action, saying she could feel the spiritual value of the sacred site and just wanted Australia to rock. And then shortly after that, an Aussie Rules football star called Sam Newman, he took a photograph of himself teeing off with a golf ball on top of the rock and said that he managed to hit the ball 2.5 miles from the top of Uluru.
Richard Hamilton there. The British are famous for lots of things, but one of the things they're most famous for around the world is queuing. And somewhere that's famous for its long, as in very long, overnight queues endured by tennis fans is Wimbledon. As the tournament reaches its climax, our reporter Elizabeth Hodson has been finding out how those fans cope with what is probably the world's most famous queue.
So tired of waiting, tired of waiting for you.
I've just entered the grounds, not of Wimbledon itself, but Wimbledon Park, which is where the queue starts if you want to buy tickets on the day. I've been handed a 31-page booklet called A Guide to Queuing, which states that, for many, the queue is as much part of the Wimbledon experience as the tennis itself. But surely waiting 6, 7, 8 hours or even overnight would push most people to their limits, wouldn't it?
We're from the United States. We got here at 7:30 this morning. We did not expect it to be quite this impressive, but it's really been kind of fun. We made some new friends, so we've really kind of enjoyed it. It's an adventure.
I've come across a group of very chic-looking ladies drinking their Pimm's. We are sitting in queue K7. It's all very well organised. How long have you been here?
We have been here since 10 to 8. We left home at 5 o'clock this morning. We've been the last 2 years, and we love the queuing experience. It's very organised, it's very British. We like to see people try to push in and get pushed back because they're not in the right number. We enjoy that very much.
The people we want to see play tomorrow, so we decided to actually camp. And luckily enough, they had people who left tents from yesterday.
And sleeping bags.
So we lucked out.
And so we're here, and we're going to stay all night.
The UK is a country of professional queuers, but how about companies? Because time is money after all. And who better to ask than Professor Dick Larson from MIT, who also goes by the name of Dr. Q. He thinks that one theme park in particular has perfected the art of waiting in line.
Disney is the Machiavellian expert internationally in queuing because they realized early on the primary thing is the psychology of the delay. And Disney figured this out ingeniously. For instance, if you join a Disney line and it says, well, if the line's out to here, you may expect to wait an hour. But they've deliberately overestimated that. A 60-minute may be really just a 45-minute waiting. So they're 15 minutes ahead of schedule in their psychology, and they're happy queuers.
And happy queuers shouldn't be taken for granted, according to behavioural economist Kelly Peters, chief executive of BeWorks in Toronto.
People are voluntarily going to Wimbledon and spending hours and hours and hours queuing up for a chance at getting tickets. We see that with concerts, we see that with new products. They actually serve an incredible purpose for the organisation. All of those people are actually brand ambassadors. Folks who are putting that kind of energy into it, they deserve, like, a reward.
But I get the sense that for the Wimbledon queuers, seeing a bit of tennis and making some new friends was reward enough.
That report from Elizabeth Hodson at Wimbledon, and I can tell you, I'm not a happy queuer. I made it to that queue last year. I saw how very long it was, and I'll admit it, I turned around and walked away. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.